Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unveiling today of a bold new plan by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to fight climate change, growing income inequality, rising healthcare costs, and student debt, which, in evoking FDR's landmark legacy, is called the Green New Deal. William Lawrence, an environmental activist and co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, which along with Justice Democrats and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez led the effort to bring about the Green New Deal, joins us. We'll discuss the sit-in Will organized at Nancy Pelosi's office, which led to the formation of a House Select Committee on Climate Change. And while Nancy Pelosi was snarky in her earlier dismissal of the Green New Deal, referring to it as, quote, the Green Dream or whatever they call it, nobody knows what it is, but they're for it, right? It already has 60 members of the House and 9 senators co-sponsoring it, including several presidential candidates. We'll assess the new Congresswoman's blueprint to develop a carbon-neutral economy in 10 years, switching to clean, renewable, and zero-emissions energy sources, and her document's endorsement of universal health care, a jobs guarantee, and free higher education. Then, with Trump raising the alarm in his State of the Union that socialism will take away our liberty and independence, and the likelihood that the Republicans will run against the democratic socialism of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in 2020, we will speak with a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, Bosca Sankara, the founder and editor of Jacobin magazine and a columnist for The Guardian. His forthcoming book is The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality, and we'll discuss the unrelenting demonization of socialism in America, where socialist programs like Social Security and Medicare remain universally popular. Then finally, with Minnesota's Senator Amy Klobuchar expected to enter the presidential race on Sunday, we will speak with David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He joins us to discuss reports emerging that the senator has a high turnover of staff, some of whom have complained of mistreatment, and whether she could position herself as an American Angela Merkel, even though centrists are likely to have difficulty getting traction in Democratic primaries, given the energy on the left of the party, with so much of the country opposed to Trump and his far-right supporters and Republican enablers. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. Joining us now is William Lawrence, an environmental activist and the co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, which, along with Justice Democrats and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, led the effort to bring about the Green New Deal. Will's recently organized a sit-in at Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi's office, pressuring Democrats to support the creation of the Green New Deal Select Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Lawrence.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And today, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez released a broad outline of the vision for the Green New Deal and, of course, clearly borrowing or evoking Franklin Delano Roosevelt's famous legacy. We have a co-introduction of it in the Senate by Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. And I believe 60 members of the House and 9 senators are co-sponsoring the resolution, including a number of presidential candidates. So why do you think Nancy Pelosi's threw some shade on it?
I think Representative Pelosi, frankly, is simply behind the times, and she's confused, and she's trying to figure out how to catch up as the party evolves and in some ways is leaving her behind. I mean, we saw that her ambition for the Select Committee on what she called the Committee on the Climate Crisis was far too low compared to the scale of the ambition and the pace of action that is needed. And she's proposing solutions like we need to hold some hearings to study the problem and understand it better that would have been fully adequate or appropriate perhaps 15 years ago. But now it's 2019, and we have only 11 years to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions from our economy if we are to do what the world's leading scientists are asking us to do to stop catastrophic climate change. So I think I'm not convinced that she totally gets it, frankly, and I think she's a little concerned to see that the people are moving on and they're not where she's at.
Well, specifically, she said in an interview with Politico, the Green Dream, or whatever it is, they call it, nobody knows what it is, but they're for it, right? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in being asked about that remark, said she was in no way offended. But the point that you make, is, of course, is the overriding point, is that the scientists are telling us we're reaching a point of no return in terms of global warming and the dire effects it's going to have on the globe. And that would seem to be a little bit inconsistent with having seen Speaker Pelosi celebrating when she was reelected with all of her grandchildren up there. So do you think there's a possibility that the grandkids and her own kids and the children of all of the legislators, particularly those that are standing in the way, will be able to get the attention of these lawmakers?
I think so, because we've seen the politics of this issue just completely transform in the last several months alone. Before November, there was no hope in American politics for a proportionate response to the climate crisis. But then, following our sit-in at Nancy Pelosi's office, along with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, there has been an upswelling of young people, as young as 6 or 8 years old, who have been joining Sunrise Movement and calling for the Green New Deal. And we've seen that, you know, over 60 members and counting of the Democratic House are getting on board. So we're going to always have our hand extended to Speaker Pelosi in the hope that she'll join us. But until then, it's very clear who the leaders of the party are and who the future of the party is, and it's not her.
And you were successful, though, were you not, Will Lawrence, in getting this climate change select committee formed?
Yes, that's right. We were calling for a select committee on a Green New Deal. And as a result of those efforts, Speaker Pelosi ended up creating something called the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, which does not have the teeth or the mandate that we were calling for. For instance, it doesn't have the power to subpoena, which means we can't investigate the records of fossil fuel billionaire executives who have been covering up this issue. But it is better than no committee.
Now, the Green New Deal, of course, encompasses quite a bit in terms of economic and racial injustice, along with fighting climate change. There's also endorsing universal health care, a jobs guarantee, free higher education, and a number of, well, obviously the main focus is on trying to limit pollution, CO2 pollution, which causes climate change. And, of course, the Trump administration at every turn have put Dracula in charge of the blood bank in terms of the EPA and the Department of Interior. So it's a hell of a fight ahead. What's your sense of who is the main enemy here in terms of being a roadblock to dealing with this reality?
Yeah. The enemy is very clear to us, and that is the billionaire fossil fuel executives who have known about climate change since the 1970s and deliberately covered it up. They invented climate denial for the purpose of being able to continue to profit, make ungodly amounts of money by continuing to threaten our futures and destroy the planet. And the way that they've entangled themselves with the political elites, especially, it must be said, the GOP elites, the Republican political establishment, who have become almost entirely enthralled to the fossil fuel billionaires, and many of them actually at this point do come from that industry. and have been lobbyists or lawyers or CEOs in that industry. And so that's the real enemy, is this entanglement of GOP elites and fossil fuel billionaires. And we're working to move the Democratic Party in a direction that it actually is a party led by the people and a party of the people, because we know that the Democrats are the only party that stand a chance of getting us out of this mess.
And have the Democrats stopped taking money from these very people that you just noted?
Many of them have. In the 2018 election cycle, we worked on something called the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge, which was just that. And we successfully pushed over 1,300 candidates from city council level all the way up to senatorial level to reject campaign cash from big oil. And the vast majority of those were Democrats. Now, there are still too many in the party who are taking that money, but we're continuing with the No Fossil Fuel Money campaign and expect that to be an absolute prerequisite to gain the support of young people in the upcoming election.
Well, it seems that Senator Bernie Sanders demonstrated an alternative to our, or a way around our money-driven politics, which, of course, since the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, have clearly given millionaires and billionaires an ability to essentially buy our politicians wholesale without any attribution. And frankly, our legislators and our representatives have become telemarketers. They still spend most of their day dialing for dollars and very little time doing the people's business. But there is, at least to my mind, something hopeful going on here with the Sanders campaign showing how small donations can give you enough money. And of course, you know, nobody likes the fact that you have to deal in this money-driven environment, but that's the reality. And more recently, of course, Beto O'Rourke and others have shown the way. So is it possible that you can not only use small donations to become competitive in terms of elections, but also competitive against the Koch brothers and others who are funding the denial? And
absolutely. Yeah, I do believe it's possible. Of course, we need campaign finance reform, but pending that, the small dollar system is a huge advantage for progressive challengers. And you know what it made me think of is the question that Representative Ocasio-Cortez gets asked repeatedly is, "Oh, how do we do so? Can you give us some advice about how to do well on social media? Or how do we do well with small dollar fundraising like you've done such a good job of?" She's getting asked this all the time, often in public by other politicians. And she says, "Well, I'll tell you my secret to social media. It's support a Green New Deal, support Medicare for All, and support free higher education, and then, you know, four or five other policy ideas." And the great thing about social media, the redemptive thing about the internet, although there's a lot that's bad about it, is that you can connect with people directly. And the American people and young people in particular are in support of the Green New Deal, and they're in support of all these policy ideas. And so when you speak about them, like AOC has and like Senator Sanders has, people are willing to put their money down to support that vision of our country.
So in other words, you've got to stand for something, and something that people
absolutely
want.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of these other people aren't raising the small dollars, not because they don't know how to use Twitter, but because they don't have anything to say.
Well, you know, this is not exactly rocket science, and it's certainly nothing new. We've had social democracy in many other European countries for decades and decades. And the simple premise of social democracy is that you vote for your representatives to be good stewards of your tax monies and provide you with social services. And for some reason or other, the whole idea of social democracy has been demonized. And in effect, it's being used as a screen for the fact that we actually have right-wing welfare in this country. We have socialism for the rich and the powerful, for the military-industrial complex, for agribusiness, etc. So that seems to be the spell that has to be broken, and I guess to some extent the younger generation have figured this out.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think you put your finger right on it, is what we're fighting for here is a revitalized conception of the role of government in American life. It's the idea that government is actually the organized will of the people at its best. And an active government acting in the will of the people is the only thing that can prevent against the abuses of these massive multinational corporations who are accountable to nothing except the profit motive. And it's also the only organized force that can, modernize our economy and our society at the pace that is needed to prevent the absolute catastrophe of climate change. If you're concerned about climate change, the only solution is an active and robust government acting in the interest of the common good to solve this problem and bring us to a better place together.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Will Lawrence, given that you're the co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, which along with the Justice Democrats drafted the Green New Deal, could you just quickly encapsulate what would decarbonizing the economy actually look like in terms of technologies and how it's going to be implemented and how we're going to motivate people to do it? And what are we going to do in terms of getting rid of oil and gas and particularly coal and move to other forms of generation that are carbon neutral? And also, of course, I guess, what do you do about nuclear power?
Yeah, so I had to clarify that Sunrise did not draft the resolution. The resolution was drafted by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey. We were consulted on it, but along with many other organizations. However, we have clearly been enthusiastically backing it. But our main role is in organizing young people and building the public support rather than in the details of policy formation. But even so, the outlines of the Green New Deal are that we need to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions from the economy as soon as possible. That means specifically overhauling our energy system to move away from polluting fuels and towards wind and solar. We need to be overhauling our transit system by investing in affordable mass transit like trains, better bus systems, things that actually just are absolutely essential for working class people around this country but have been completely underinvested in compared to any other developed country in the world. Our public transit system is an absolute embarrassment. And we need to overhaul our food system, which is also a major source of greenhouse gas emissions through industrial agriculture. We need to be moving towards more regenerative agriculture as well as local scale agriculture, family farmers, and taking that down to a community level whenever possible, which also just improves our quality of life immensely to have the production of food in our backyards. And then, as you mentioned, a key aspect of this is a job guarantee program, because as you're probably listening, you think, boy, that sounds like a lot of work, and it absolutely is. But the silver lining is that there are plenty of people in this country who are ready to work and who need work. We have unemployment and underemployment in this country, although it doesn't show up in the statistics. People have dropped out of the labor force but would love to be working in the service of an ambitious project to better our communities, like the Green New Deal. So that's a key component, job guarantee with a family-sustaining wage. And number three is we have to do all this in a way which is not leading to further concentration of wealth and control by a few small, massive corporations, but instead doing all this in a way that is building wealth, building ownership at a community level, and particularly doing this in a way which is about rectifying and addressing the historic injustices that have been done to communities of color and indigenous communities and other communities that have been left behind by our broken economy. Because we're going to be making a massive investment, and it's critical that we do this in a way that is not repeating the mistakes of the past. So those are the basic components of a Green New Deal.
And in terms of nuclear power, does it have a a place in the Green New Deal?
You know, that's something that we're are listening to a lot of different people on, and the understanding is we do not need to be investing in new nuclear facilities at any sort of scale. But I think there's big questions about how rapidly the existing facilities can or should be decommissioned. And I'm not an expert in that area, but that's one of the issues that the policy analysts are looking at very seriously.
Well, just in closing, one of the things that I find particularly outrageous about the current economy is that our future generation, your generation, Will Lawrence, have become indentured with student debt before they get a job. And we should be investing in our students as opposed to making them centers of profits. But that is what's happening. Is there any way that you can reverse that?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it just really speaks to how twisted our priorities have become, that we are systematically defunding public education and then asking students, to young people, to go into tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt in order to get the basic education that they need to succeed. We became one of the most prosperous, or the most prosperous country on earth, by investing in education in a way that no other country had previously. And if we want to continue, if we want to be a prosperous nation again, we're going to have to reinvest in education, and we absolutely need to wipe out the student debt that is saddling so many people.
Well, Will Lawrence, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's been great to be here, and hope we can come back sometime.
Absolutely. And again, I've been speaking with William Lawrence, who is an environmental activist and the co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, which, along with Justice Democrats and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, led the effort to bring about the Green New Deal. Will recently organized a sit-in at Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi's office, pressuring Democrats to support the creation of the Green New Deal Select Committee. We can take a brief station break, and we'll be back discussing the unrelenting demonization of socialism in America, where socialist programs like Social Security and Medicare remain universally popular.
Some of them get through, but there's better people with more good to do, good to do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Bhaskar Sankara, who is the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine and a columnist for The Guardian. He is the author of the forthcoming book, The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bhaskar Sankara.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the President of the United States in his State of the Union tried to conflate socialism in America with socialism in Venezuela, and vowed that socialism would never happen here in the United States. Of course, it already has happened in terms of Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, etc. But what's behind this? It's almost like they're positioning themselves, both Trump and the Republicans, for a campaign issue here, using the specter of socialism as a kind of a rallying cry.
Well, it's nothing new for the right. Of course, the right during the Obama years was summoning the specter of socialism when it came to just the most mild attempts at health care reform that Obama was pushing. And obviously, in many ways, those of us on the left, you know, myself included, thought of Obamacare in many ways as a giveaway to insurance companies. But of course, it was used by the right then And I think for those of us like myself who are socialists, we should be thankful that we have the opportunity to talk about our politics and to talk about socialism as the expansion of social protections, about the expansion of power of working class people and rights and freedom to working class people, and that people are associating it with these reforms rather than, you know, bread lines and gulags. You know, I think that's a step in the right direction. But there's no doubt that the Republicans are extremely afraid of the popularity of Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other politicians in the Democratic Party and outside the Democratic Party that are embracing the socialist label. I mean, they're going to call us socialists anyway. We might as well grapple with the history of socialism and talk about how it's different than mainstream liberalism.
So are you saying then, Bhaskar Sankara, that Trump is actually going to help you?
Well, yeah, I think that for most Americans, particularly young Americans, you know, the slur isn't sticking anymore. I think people are looking at what mainstream liberalism, kind of Clintonite liberalism, has given them, which is just death by a thousand cuts when it comes to austerity. And then they're looking at the Republican solution to the economy and other issues, which seems to be primarily tax cuts for the rich and finding scapegoats among immigrants and other marginalized, excluded people. And they're looking for an alternative. And they're looking for a type of politics that speaks to their anger, but also is connected with constructive policies. So when we think about the most prominent socialists in America today, we're thinking of Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders, of course, is connected to Medicare for All, his primary policy push. When we think about AOC, we think about her politics being connected to the Green New Deal. So it's not just an angry sort of negation of everything that's going on. I think to be a socialist today is to have concrete, tangible vision for a positive change in this country. So I really do think that it's not going to hurt us having an unpopular president attack the idea of socialism.
And where is it going to manifest itself in terms of political parties? Are you a member of the Democratic Socialists of America?
I'm a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is too. We tend to endorse candidates who run through Democratic primaries. So by virtue of our undemocratic two-party system, if you want to be a credible candidate in a congressional race, if you want to be a credible candidate in any sort of national race, like a presidential race, you have to run through one of the two major parties. It's unfortunate. It's a state of affairs that we need to reform. But for now, I think that one can operate in democratic primaries as an open socialist, talking about the issues that we care about, talking about our agenda. So I don't think anyone has to worry about the spoiler effect when it comes to democratic socialism in America today.
So, Bhaskar, I've always thought that if the Tea Party, they call themselves the Freedom Caucus now, if they could become the tail that wags the dog of the GOP, there's no reason why progressives and leftists couldn't, in fact, take over the Democratic Party, because it's kind of a brain-dead shell. And, you know, the consultants they've had over the years are serial losers. And it seems to me that the only energy and excitement I've seen coming out of the Democratic Party, and frankly, none of the candidates running for president I find particularly exciting at this point. We'll see. But it would seem to me that that is a viable possibility, isn't it? I mean, do you see the idea that, at least do you accept that parallel, the idea that a bunch of crazies can take over the GOP? Why can't a bunch of idealists take over the Democratic Party?
I think for sure there's an opportunity to change and transform the Democratic Party through the efforts of socialists and other progressives. Now, I still believe that in the long run, we're going to need a third party built on a different basis. And this third party, of course, would have to very rapidly become the second party by virtue of the U.S. system. So I think we're still years, if not decades, away from this this happening. But I think that a different sort of party structure is needed. And I think you get at part of the problem with the Democratic Party in that it's very diffuse. It is really just a shell in many ways, but that in many ways becomes a source of strength for the corporate interests within the party. So in other words, when it comes to the Labour Party in the UK, we know that there's a Labour Party leadership election that the left can contest, and in the case of Corbyn, actually win. We know that there's CLPs, constituency Labour parties, that one can run candidates in and run election campaigns to change your MPs. You know exactly where the key battles are. The Democratic Party, it becomes very hard to figure out what fortress to storm when there seems to be, you know, 1,000 of them. So I imagine that a different sort of party, a party built around the interests of working people in this country, would be a party that's connected to labor unions, that's connected with community associations, that has assemblies and get-togethers in local communities. It's a party that actually calls protests and rallies. So I think, in other words, we need a different party than the Democratic Party for our long-term objectives. In the short term, one can certainly push progressive policy through the platform afforded to us by the Democratic Party. And I think we need to just be aware that the enemies won't just be in the Republican Party, they'll be within the Democratic Party as well. I'd be hard-pressed to be convinced that someone like Joe Biden, you know, a long-term, you know, senator for the credit card companies out of Delaware, is going to be on the same page as Sanders and AOC and Rashida and the other progressives in Congress. I think that there's just, in fact, many parties in the United States, and they just happen to be awkwardly trying to fit within the shell of two different parties.
Well, there's nothing controversial about being a socialist in most countries, and particularly in developed countries. Most of the European governments have been socialist for the longest time, or at least democratic socialist, or practicing what's called social democracy, which is a simple formula where you vote for politicians who become stewards of the tax money that you pay, and in return for their stewardship, they provide you with government services. And, of course, we have developed a form of right-wing socialism in this country with essentially socialism for the rich and powerful through the military-industrial complex and agribusiness. And I think one of the more glaring examples, of course, are the billionaire owners of NFL teams that managed to get socialist subsidies to build stadiums. So it's all over the place, right-wing socialism, and it's never talked about. But what is talked about in this country for actually not just decades, it's been centuries now, the demonization of the very word socialism. And obviously, communism gave socialism a bad name. But to my mind, that is your greatest problem. Is how do you bridge that gap of demonization and get to the point where we already know that the majority of Americans recognize things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid as good programs without knowing that they're socialists? So that seems to me to be a real challenge.
Yeah, I think that there's many reasons that people are skeptical of the history, certain histories of socialisms in power. You know, you can look at the experience of the Soviet Union, the experience of other communist countries, and these were obviously authoritarian states. But as you point out, you could also look at the experience of a social democracy in countries like Sweden and countries like Norway, where they took backwards on unequal societies, and through long periods of social democratic governance, they became thriving, advanced, rich, and most importantly, equitable countries that had extensive social safety nets. And within those countries, there were pushes for greater and greater democracy. So in Sweden in the 1960s and 70s, not merely content with having a welfare state, workers in their main trade union confederation and within their ruling Social Democratic Party pushed for measures to have industrial democracy. So in other words, their logic was, well, if democracy is good in the political sphere, if the welfare state is good, why don't we have more say in our workplaces? Why is the workplace from 9 to 5 a tyranny where democracy can't penetrate, where we're held to the whims of unaccountable managers and bosses? So to me, the struggle for what I call socialism is a struggle for more freedom, for more dignity, for more rights. And of course, in the United States, it's been demonized for the longest time, even before the rise of the Soviet Union and what the Soviet Union became under Stalin. Socialists were persecuted in the United States. They were held as being unpatriotic. They were the only force in the United States, major force, fighting against World War One, and its leaders were in prison. Eugene Debs ran for prison in 1920 from a prison cell. So I find it hard to believe that the right is just attacking us because of the real history of authoritarianism in some parts of the socialist tradition, because, you know, it's happening well before the Soviet Union ever existed. I think it's more that there are certain powerful interests that benefit from the status quo, that benefit from you not having health care, that benefit from you having to deal with unemployment and housing insecurity. And these are the people who own wealth and power in the United States. And they get their leverage from us being in a precarious situation. What democratic socialists say is we could be in a different situation. We could collectively use the power of the state, use the power of our collective institutions, and guarantee basic rights for ordinary people. And if you look at the polling on each of these issues, 60%+ of the Americans believe in things like job guarantees, believe in Medicare for all. So we're finally, I think, penetrating through the fog.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, the argument, of course, is that socialism is the opposite of capitalism, or at least wants to get rid of capitalism. But there again is a huge lie, because the countries that you cited, Norway and Sweden, I think something over 90% of their economy is in private hands. So that seems to be another canard that you have to deal with, the idea that socialism means the nationalization of all capitalist enterprises.
Well, I do think that if you take socialist ideas to their logical endpoint, we have to end up with the socialization of production in some sense. And by that, I don't mean nationalization and central planning in the Soviet style, but I'll explain it this way. You're right that in these Scandinavian countries, they had a functional socialism in which socialist ends were largely attained, but through means that socialists themselves didn't anticipate. So we keep a private enterprise, but instead we taxed and regulated it and built a welfare state so that we were harnessing the power of capitalism to achieve social outcomes. But when you do that, you end up leaving the structural power of society in the hands of capitalists. Then when the moment arises, like arose in many of these countries in the late 1970s and the 1980s, capital will always be able to launch a counteroffensive. They'll always be able to use their commanding force in society to roll back reforms. And if you look at the welfare state in Sweden now, while still quite impressive by American standards, it's nowhere near where it was in the 1970s and 1980s. So I do believe that we need to find a way to socialize production, which means taking the power away from capitalists and putting it in the hands of cooperatives and other ways of organizing production that I think you're absolutely right would still involve the market, but I'm not sure would involve private ownership in the same way. And for certain sectors, I do think we need to get rid of private ownership completely and right away. There's no reason for there to be privately run hospitals and ambulances and things like that in the United States today. You know, if sure. You know, your house is on fire or you have a gas leak, you know, the fireman don't come to your house and check to see if you're okay and then leave with the bill. You know, so there are certain sectors that I certainly believe the state can be in. In other sectors, I think workers collectively can form cooperatives, and even if they're still competing in the market, I don't think there's a need for the type of hierarchy that you have in the capitalist workplace.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Moskos and Kara, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
Take care. And again, I've been speaking with Bhaskar Sankara, who's the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine and a columnist for The Guardian. And he's the author of the forthcoming book, The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the entry into the presidential race on Sunday by Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar.
Lost in an oscillating phase where a tiny few catch all of the rain. might shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left, took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of 30 books and various articles on American politics, ethics, election law, and the media. Most recently, Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. And he has an article at his website, Schultz's Take, Klobuchar for President, Her Chances Are Less Than Most Minnesotans Think. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Schultz.
Thank you for having me.
And David, I'd heard some time back from staffers on the Hill that Amy Klobuchar was very unpopular and staffers didn't want to work for her. And now the Huffington Post has come out with a story saying that at least three people have withdrawn from consideration to lead Senator Klobuchar's presidential campaign, which she's expected to announce on Sunday in Minneapolis. And it goes into some detail about complaints about her. So what is the local take on her? Have you heard complaints about her being a tough boss to work for?
Well, her public persona and public image, I think, is very sculptured, and it is of sort of classic phrase we use, Minnesota nice. However, if we take us back to sort of even at the time when she was Hennepin County, which is the county where Minneapolis is, as a Hennepin County attorney, she had a reputation back then of being exceedingly hard on her staff and very difficult to get along with. And we'll call it the dirty little secret in Minnesota. Not the general public consumption, but the dirty little secret is that she has the highest turnover of any senator in the United States Senate in terms of staff, and that she's exceedingly rough on her staff. And so again, her public persona versus what we hear from the insiders in Capitol Hill versus what we know in terms of the statistics on turnover create very different images.
Well, apparently this has been noted by Legistorm, which is the database for congressional staff salaries. They are saying that Klobuchar's office has consistently had one of the highest rates of staff turnover in the Senate, and her turnover rate ranked number one in analysis by the Legistorm from 2001 to 2016. And of course, she was sworn in actually in 2017. Apparently now on this same database, Legistorm, she's third in terms of staff turnover behind Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen and Louisiana Republican John Kennedy. So there seems to be some evidence to back up these claims.
Yes. The other bit of evidence I can give you, too, and because I teach in Minnesota, I'm a political science professor, law professor, many of my students oftentimes look for internships with elected officials. And it's interesting that I had a conversation recently with one of my students who said that she may be pursuing an internship there. And I said, well, that's okay. And this person said that at the same time, yeah, it looks very good on the resume. She got the sense from being in the office that while the staff is very nice, could feel the dysfunction of her office in terms of the turnover. So if I can throw that in as another bit of anecdotal evidence in terms of her management style, it does come across that she might say it as high expectations. There are many who describe the style of her office as demeaning, as intimidating, perhaps even some would say hostile environment.
Well, she just won her seat in the last election cycle, a Senate seat representing Minnesota, with 60% of the popular vote. That's
yes.
Pretty good. I mean, this is a state that, swings both ways, right? You've had Walter Mondale, Hubert Humphrey, but you've also had Tim Pawlenty and Michelle Bachmann.
No, you're absolutely correct, is that it's a state that is traditionally noted as a liberal democratic state, but of which has a very powerful conservative political tradition in it. We are the only state in the country right now where the state legislature is split. Our upper house is Republican, our lower house is Democrat, and paralleling what we find in Congress. So in many ways, we are a very divided state. But Klobuchar is perhaps the smartest politician in the state of Minnesota. She's been very, very effective, again, in creating a very good image. She has never gone out on a limb in terms of pursuing controversial issues. Her constituent service is outstanding, and she benefited tremendously when she first ran for office from both the patronage and support of Walter Mondale, and at the same time, Klobuchar is a very well-respected name in Minnesota, her father being a journalist for the major newspaper in the state. So she's done a very good job of again, working her image. I think the other thing that helped her quite a bit is back in 2008 when Norm Coleman and Al Franken had a very, very close Senate race, and we weren't able to seat Al Franken until almost July of 2009, a six-month legal battle. Klobuchar was the only senator in Minnesota during that time, and she earned a lot of goodwill from a lot of people because she did double duty, and she served both the, let's say, traditional interests that you might see a senator serve as a Democrat, but also served a lot of the traditional corporate and business interests in terms of performing her duties. So she's done a lot of very good things in terms of helping and build her image. And for Minnesota, she has in many ways a classic persona. You know, it's not a flamboyant persona. It is, for people who want to conjure up the stereotype of classic Midwestern nice, she comes across exactly as that in Minnesota to most of the people.
So I noticed that she's changed her hairstyle. I guess she's getting ready for the announcement on Sunday. But she's only in terms of this race with a lot of Democrats running, perhaps as many as 20 or more. The latest Washington Post poll has her at 2%. So she's not registering, but maybe she'll get an uptick on Sunday. I always thought, David, that I didn't know that much about her until, as I say, this friend on the Hill said she's got this reputation of being kind of unpleasant to work for. I always thought she'd be the perfect candidate. You know, if America could elect a Angela Merkel, somebody that is no nonsense, not glamorous, but hardworking and sensible and incredibly competent, that to me would be the winning ticket. So to what extent could she sort of fill that mold or appear to fill that mold of an American Angela Merkel?
Well, that's exactly how I could describe her also. She's smart, she's competent, she's hardworking. She has done her best to try to work across the aisles, which is what some people say. But all those things probably exclude her from being a serious candidate for president of the United States in some ways. And I say that because if she were running in an era where politics wasn't polarized, and an era where perhaps 30 years ago, where those were viewed as virtues, she would be an outstanding candidate. But we're at a time now when the two parties, as we know, are polarized. We also know that, you know, both parties are moving farther and far away from one another. We're looking at this year going into 2020 that the Democratic candidates for president are pulling to the left, that in many ways Bernie Sanders had a big impact upon the party back in 16 and moving the party to the left. And Klobuchar is running as a centrist at a time when the Democratic Party is moving further to the left. I describe her as in many ways a Clinton Democrat. And I'm not sure running as a Clinton Democrat works anymore, or to point out the fact that, what was it, about 2 weeks ago, the conservative columnist George Will wrote a glowing piece of her saying that, you know, she would be an ideal candidate for president. I'm not sure among a a moving left Democratic base, getting an endorsement from George Will helps you very much anymore.
So is there a path, a default? Because many of these candidates, to my mind, appear to be running, the Democrats appear to be running for vice president. Is there a path there or a default position for her?
Perhaps. But this becomes the question of who the other candidate is. And let's say, for example, that Senator Kamala Harris, you know, your senator in California, you know, were to get the nomination. I think it would be very difficult for a Harris-Klobuchar ticket. Some people have said, well, maybe if Biden were to run, would a Biden-Klobuchar ticket be a possibility? Perhaps, yes. So it's going to depend on the exact combination of people in terms of who gets the presidential nod. But we also should think about what's the value that a vice presidential candidate brings. And even though I know both parties go through a lot of machinations and a lot of thinking about vice presidential candidates, at the end of the day, they really don't matter. With the exception recently of Sarah Palin back in 08, who clearly hurt John McCain. Think about it. Most Americans can't name the sitting vice president, and there's very little evidence that vice presidents have that much of a pull in terms of anybody. There's a belief that the vice president helps you win your home state. Well, Minnesota is still relatively solid as a Democratic state. So it would be hard to see the scenario where Klobuchar would definitely be a top pick for vice president. More likely than not, like back in 2016, had Clinton won, we would have seen perhaps Amy Klobuchar as Attorney General Klobuchar, or Amy Klobuchar perhaps as Associate Justice Klobuchar of the Supreme Court. I see that as a more likely scenario after 2020 if the Democrats were to take back the White House.
Well, of course, you can't really run on a ticket as a presidential candidate with a vice president. That happens right after the presidential candidate wins the nomination.
Of course.
But there are people like, for example, Julian Castro, who doesn't seem to be a viable presidential candidate but may see himself as a possible VP pick. So I guess a lot of them run to join this crowded field in order to get some the recognition that it may require. So but let's look at her record, because in the piece that you wrote, David Schultz, Klobuchar for president, her chances are less than most Minnesotans think. First of all, she doesn't have much of a legislative record, does she? I'm looking around for some stuff. I know she's been focusing on job creation, and she's the co-sponsor of the Skills Investment Act of 2019 with Ben Sasse, the Republican of Nebraska. But has she had any legislative achievements?
Not really notable ones. And part of the problem has been that during most of the time she's been in the U.S. Senate, she's been in the minority, which of course means that you don't get an awful lot of opportunity to get your legislation heard or passed. And so I think that's been one difficulty. The second thing is that, you know, she has not been compared to, say, some senators like a Warren, for example, you know, who have proposed bold things, getting a lot of attention. She really, Amy Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar, really hasn't pursued a rich legislative agenda. She's done, again, legislation that might have good value to constituents back in Minnesota, but in terms of major accomplishments, it really is hard to sort of come up with a clear record of accomplishment, you know, for her in terms of her being able to tick off the major bills that she was responsible for having passed the Senate and become law.
Well, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren. She's obviously very, very qualified, but unfortunately she's being more and more saddled by this. Trump's labeled her Pocahontas, but she's obviously mm-hmm. tried to get out from under by doing that DNA test, which backfired. Obviously, politically, she should have at least consulted the tribes before she did that, and they came out against her, which didn't help. And then now there's a revelation that she's, in terms of her application to the Texas bar, she described herself as an American Indian. And in the ambush interviews in the Senate the other day, she was asked whether there are other more shoes to drop, and she left that open. So I have a feeling that she's going to be dogged by this charge of cultural expropriation, I guess it's called, right. which is unfortunate, because I think she's probably one of the most talented people out there in the field. Do you think that she may be able to survive Elizabeth Warren? And if not, would that help Klobuchar?
Well, first off, it's a good question. I agree with you that the damage that either Trump inflicted upon her or a little bit of self-inflicted, and it's hard to decide which it is, I think have hurt her campaign quite a bit. And she does, though, still enjoy clearly support among some of the left of the parties. So it's going to be a question of how she maneuvers, through the Iowa caucuses and obviously through the early primaries, she's not going away right away, but she clearly is a more damaged candidate than before. I think that leaves some opportunity for Klobuchar, but where I think Klobuchar faces her biggest challenge again is with somebody such as Senator Harris, Kamala Harris, because part of the strength that Klobuchar brings is her argument of experience. She said that I've been a former prosecutor or county attorney. I'm a three-term senator. And she sort of touts that very strongly. And again, thinking of somebody like Kamala Harris, prosecutor in San Francisco, attorney general, I believe she was a state legislator, correct me if I'm wrong, and
no,
also now a senator.
No.
These are going to be competing narratives that are going to be out there in terms of qualifications. And I think one of the challenges for Klobuchar will be to show how her qualifications are unique to make her appealable both to the Democratic base and then electable in a general election come 2020.
So
not impossible to do.
Well, just in the last minute, David Schultz, what are the local newspapers reporting about these revelations about her high staff turnover?
The Star Tribune, which is the major newspaper in Minneapolis, reported on the Huffington Post piece today. And I could say that that's the first time that I think any Minnesota media or newspaper has reported, again, what's been in many ways considered the best kept secret. Now, how this plays out in Minnesota, at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to hurt her here. Again, 60% in terms of her last election. She's got the highest approval ratings in the state. She will unequivocally get the support of Democrats in the state, and unequivocally get the support of most people in the state of Minnesota. So it won't hurt her here. The question is, to what extent does this hurt her capacity to build a campaign staff? And B, is it a story that resonates nationwide in terms of hurting your campaign?
Well, David Schultz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Schultz. He's a professor of political science in Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of 30 books and various articles on American politics, ethics, election law, and the media. And his most recent books are Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. And he has an article at his website, Schultz's Take. Klobuchar for president, her chances are less than most Minnesotans think. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.